listened to every single podcast on oneofus.net. What do I do now?
Well, first of all, how is that even possible? But secondly, I think I have a solution for you, Chris.
There can be no solution, Brian.
There is a solution, and that solution is our newest sponsor, Audible.com. Guys, if you haven't tried Audible.com, now is the perfect time to do that. We're talking about content that includes over 150,000 audio programs. We're talking about books on digital, audio dramas, broadcasters, magazine and newspaper publishers, all the greatest stuff you can possibly imagine in one place just for you.
Okay, that actually does sound pretty good.
Doesn't that sound great? And you know what? I'm going to make it sound even greater, Chris, because they are officially, Audible is officially one of our sponsors here at oneofus.net, and as a special gift to you guys, Audible is giving away a free audiobook. All you have to do is click on the link at the bottom of this page, or you can go to audibletrial.com/oneofus.
You mean to say that by clicking on audible.com and downloading their free book, they make sure by listening to that audio that we keep making more audio as well?
That's right, and the cycle continues.
Recording high atop the 60th floor of the 27th largest building in the world and the 9th most expensive city in the world. It's Dystopian Present. I'm your host, Ross, and I'm joined by Rachel and Alice, and we're gonna talk some Hong Kong and Greater China geekery. So, guys, where shall we start?
It has been some interesting political stuff happening, some stuff.
Indeed.
It's crazy, actually. I think that's the right word for one of the stories, maybe both of the stories that we're covering. Should we start with the school, or should we start with the tragedy?
Crazy school or crazy tragedy? Let's go school. Crazy okay. school.
Crazy school, I think, is a potentially shorter topic,
but okay.
A kerfuffle is maybe calling it something too light for what it actually was. A rugby match, a scrimmage, a small battle ensued when an administrator at Hong Kong University, which is...
Pro-Vice-Chancellor.
Pro-Vice-Chancellor.
Whoa.
Which is a big deal, if like, we weren't sure. I think Hong Kong University is the best and most prestigious university in Hong Kong.
Sounds like a special
it's generally the most internationally highly rated. And it's certainly the most locally prestigious and has the kind of longest history here.
So this exalted personage suggested that it should be mandatory for all students to spend time in mainland China.
What he actually said was
Please.
That hopefully incorrectly stating his rank will help with that. what he actually said behind. In a relatively private forum, still too public, frankly, was that students who didn't want to spend a term in mainland China would not be welcome at HKU. And this was describing a plan that's supposed to roll in by 2022. There are actually, it turns out, while there are many excellent reasons to study in China, and...
Political indoctrination is not one of them.
Well, it depends on whether you'd like to be politically indoctrinated. But, a lot of, particularly, actually, enrollment abroad in Hong Kong has depended for many years on people who felt they were getting access to China, and the distinctiveness of Hong Kong both makes it possible for them to study here and also is at some remove from China.
Right.
Academically. So in terms of, I think there are many people for whom a kind of easy path into studying in China, even a well-worn path, would be an attraction. All of those people who are, kind of studying in China under the rubric of China, what's in it for us?
Right. It's the biggest economy.
But it turns out that there are a lot of people currently studying at Hong Kong U, but also other universities, two others of which have in recent years refused to do this kind of programming, who don't wants to study in China.
Because they come from China.
Some of them come from China. Some of them come from places that don't get on that well with China.
Right.
Including Taiwan.
The Philippines.
And
which
also
will come up later.
And also including everybody...
Foreshadowing. I like it.
Indeed.
Everybody who was named as a participant in last year's Umbrella.
Right. So if you were in a pup tent on a road in Central last year, you are on the government list. Let me do a quick timeout. I wanted to give the listening public at home a little bit of flash forward into what's going on tonight. We're going to talk about some Hong Kong and China local politics. We're going to talk about Hong Kong geekery, including local bands and movies. And we're going to get into some global geekery, including, I suspect, a bit of a smackdown on the new Netflix Daredevil series. So that's all to come on this week's Dystopian.
We're just going to foreshadow here the sound of a fist hitting a sack of meat.
Okay. On many, many different levels. Just before we dive further into the rabbit hole. So let me big picture this, or let me ask you guys to big picture this. A major university, the preeminent University of Hong Kong, saying and then not saying that it's their students should go and make obeisance to the mainland. How's that going to net out politically for Hong Kong? Is this a flash in the pan or is this serious?
I think that people are trying to find a way forward from last year, but what is happening is just really clumsy,
right?
As the poor vice chancellor said, and that we may also be, you know, as the you know, this is also was this today? It was today that the Hong Kong government announced what the you know, what the proposal for voting is actually going to be, and no concession.
Which is, if you've ever slept in a pup tent, you don't get a vote.
And you know, well, and on top of that, well, you do get a vote. You
right.
do get a vote, but you get to vote for who we say you vote for.
Right.
And basically, no, they haven't moved an inch. And
right.
you have people who are trying to, you know, trying to move towards this immovable object. And in the theory that it will somehow be met with something civil.
Right.
And that's not actually going to
I'm kind of
happen.
Looking for a more thumbs-up, thumbs-down assessment.
Oh. really thumbs-down on really anything that involves mandatory and mainland in Hong Kong education.
Yes.
And a lot of the pushback against this, really, the background for this, is that in secondary schools, high schools
right.
all over Hong Kong, you have various kinds of trips or attempts, depending on
yeah.
the organization, to make trips, which are pretty clearly about, you know, forms of political indoctrination. And this is, you know, this is what people have in mind. It really
right.
isn't that you couldn't go and have a, you know, an interesting experience living in Shanghai for a year. It's
yeah.
but this is the framework
right.
that people are both receiving this information in, and you know, HKU, which is a very internationally looking institution, and lots of people go abroad everywhere from it, seems to not be understanding that it isn't kind of, you know, China is not only one of many countries for its own student population.
Right, right.
And this has just become really charged.
So, if we're in a scenario where China is slowly, subtly, not so subtly, forcing itself onto the, trying to find ways into our consciousness. We are still dealing with, and I'm looking for a segue here, a somewhat insular Hong Kong when it comes to who we consider to be part of Hong Kong society. Recently, there was... Thank you. I try. That's why they pay me the medium bucks. The news hit a couple of weeks ago, I think about 2 weeks back, just during the Easter holidays, that prominent expatriate family had a tragic family occurrence where a daughter of a well-heeled British expatriate couple committed suicide off of their luxury flat, jumped several stories to her death. It was then revealed that she and her sister had been living illegally since birth in Hong Kong by virtue of the fact that their mother was a domestic helper who then moved in with a British expatriate who was
working for an international global company.
Yes, exactly. I mean, the international press had made him out to be some sort of kingpin
a corporate executive.
Yeah. He was reasonably high up the stack. He certainly wasn't at the top of the stack. It was one of those rarefied positions, but not completely rare positions, where the guy had a good gig and had been in Hong Kong forever. We know lots of guys like this. There's a sort of thick crust of British expatria that will stay here until the gig is up. And this family in particular lived a great life for a long time, but the wife and the children were completely illegal. I don't know to what extent, maybe you guys have read more into this, but I don't know to what extent that whole sort of shadow state within which they lived caused the girl's death. The thing that I want to talk about is the international media sensation, the local media sensation that was created, and the Hong Kongness of it all, because the whole reason this was a thing was that the common law wife was a domestic helper who then
had been a domestic helper. She had lived as his wife, although they were not legally married for a decade and a half, and they had two children, 14 and 15, and they were and actually the first there were kind of three legal allegations made, and. The first kind of Hong Kong touch
Hong is, Kong legal corner.
Yeah, Hong Kong legal corner. But the first kind of setting thing is, okay, so a teenage girl commits suicide, and authorities are said to be assisting the family.
Mm.
What do they mean by assisting the family? They mean
nothing.
Arresting the mother for overstaying her visa. Detaining the father for questioning, accusing both of them of ill treatment of a child, and legal consequences of that are a little fuzzy.
Yeah.
And they take the younger sister into care, by which they mean they put her in a juvenile facility.
Yeah.
She is later released, all charges against the father are dropped, and those against the mother are left standing, including ill treatment.
We should take a step back and just talk a little bit about what the helper situation is in Hong Kong.
That's good too.
But for the readers at home. Because I think what's important to understand is that if you come over as a helper, you are likely to be Filipino or Indonesian. You will not probably blend with the local population. You are unlikely to speak Cantonese or Mandarin, at least.
I'm going to push back on that. Yes. Every single Indonesian helper in this town... Okay. Speaks Cantonese like they were born.
And that's good to know. That's their market share.
I've only worked with Filipino helpers.
Right.
But you are bought on a contract where you are sponsored by a family. Mm. You're required to live with a family. Your wages are mostly set by the government, and you do not have a strong negotiating position to negotiate for higher wages.
Right.
And you are in, and you are likely in debt to the agencies which have arranged this.
And it is
illegal. Do you think that's the primary... Do you think that the majority of helpers are... I know that that happens, but do you think that happens in the majority of cases?
I think it happens initially in the majority of cases, but okay. Then there are people who are... There are many people who are in the situation where here long enough...
To pay it back.
Okay. And this is actually another dimension of this. If you are an expat on a work visa in Hong Kong, if you stay for 7 years, you can apply for permanent residency.
Hooray! Yes.
If you are a Filipino who has been here 15 years,
PR in the
or
house.
24 years, or however long, you can't apply for permanent residency.
Yes, that's an injustice, but that's somewhat not the issue here.
No, it's not. There's one more. But I just want to think this as a kind of piece of...
Yeah.
You know, that these are not... It isn't just about kind of... These are people who are not being treated equally in a regularized way.
Yeah.
And I do believe that if you are pregnant, or you find yourself to be pregnant, your family who is sponsoring you or hosting you or who your contract is with... is fined and you are deported. Is that a correct statement?
No, that's Singapore.
That's Singapore.
That, utopia to the south.
If you're pregnant,
got it.
Here you can't be fired, and your family actually do have some protection.
Yeah.
This is one of the things that makes this not the Gulf.
Right. Yeah, no, not to be a Hong Kong apologist, but actually on the scale of how Asian entrepôt cities treat their helpers, Hong Kong's actually at the top of the stack.
Yeah, it's
not a great stack to be at the top of.
So in this particular situation, when these two people found themselves in love, they had a short window between when... Right. So you cannot get married while you are on contract. You can only get married after the contract.
Actually, I don't even know that that's the case. They could have. He could have got on, bent the knee to like borrow of Game of Thronism and slowly segueing to the key part of things. He could have married her at any point in time. But what happened was they got involved before her contract ended. Her contract ended, and then the law states that domestic helpers have a month to find a new gig, and then they gotta go. And if they don't go, they are put in jail, as any overstayer of their visas is. They're put in jail for a month for every year that they overstayed. So at some point in their relationship, say 10 years on, it got to the point where they said, hey, you know, it'd be really inconvenient if we try to make this legal now.
And as a result, their children have neither birth certificates, nor passports, nor any other...
Also, yeah, they've never left Hong Kong.
Not registering a birth
is
also illegal.
Yep.
And what came out in the wake of this incident was that they really don't know how many people are not registered.
Right.
They have some statistics about... people who are registered within the statutory 42 days, then people who are registered within a few months, which tends to be about issues either of people not admitting paternity or difficulty naming. Those tend to be the issues. Before you're after a year...
I really am undecided.
Yeah, after a year...
Amber, Brittany, I don't know! I don't know!
You can't pronounce either of those. But the... The third group of people who are kind of registered after a year tends to all be... Everybody who then registers later is all paternity issues.
Right.
By the way, you have to have, in order to get one of these, get a birth certificate, the father has to sign here, which is another set of issues, and is another kind of potential group of undocumented people. So...
Is there a mechanism to force the father to sign?
There's no... the mechanism for getting anybody to register this birth is, A, the threat that you're doing something illegal by not doing it.
Yes.
B, if you don't do it, they phone you. Then C,
I don't want that
they
call.
Send a letter. A stern letter. After they send the letter, what do they do then?
Nothing.
Big fat nothing. And they've checked the boxes.
Right.
Huh.
So, and they don't gather the statistics after that.
Which
so,
indicates that there is probably some number of women who are wandering around trying to get people, men, in this particular case, to sign these with no enforcement mechanism, potentially.
Well, there's that. And also, you know, this the Hong Kong media, the South China Morning Post and others, were very adamant about this unprecedented situation in Repulse Bay. And unprecedented is a great wiggle word, because it doesn't actually say...
Yes. No one's ever jumped off the roof of that particular building.
Well, that wasn't even the issue. It was the unprecedented situation was the...
Right.
You know, they had gone unregistered for 15 years, and nobody knows.
Right, yeah. They could be... Yeah, I mean, it's strange. It's a function of, in a weird way, Hong Kong is a bit of a Wild West city, in that you can kind of come on pretty slim pretenses and set yourself up here. I mean, you can kind of pay a few hundred dollars and register a business, and then employ yourself as managing director of that business. You know, if you've got sort of the
good to know.
Good to know.
Pro tip for all you guys out there.
Are you on the run from the law?
Come on down and get yourself incorporated in Hong Kong.
From a visa perspective, if you are an expat who is not Filipino or Indonesian, your visa is portable. You get the first one is a year, and after that it's 2 years. The visa fee is very low. It is not tied to your employer as it would be in the U.S. where your green card is tied to your employer.
I think it is not.
Really?
Oh, really?
It is definitely not.
Okay. Wow.
Says the HR person.
Good.
If you have a green card in the U.S., I have to notify the government and deport you within 3 days.
Okay, before this becomes sort of emigrate to Hong Kong pro tips, I think the bottom line here is that we're trying
to give added value.
Yeah, exactly. Come and join us live the next one. We will even sponsor you. Bottom line is there is despite the amount of kind of wiggle room that a lot of people have in coming and leaving and living in, passing through Hong Kong, there's a big chunk, and at last count there are about 500,000 domestic servants of one type or another in Hong Kong. Out of a city of 8 million people, it's a big chunk of folks. Now, you could argue that the fact that there is a class of visa that allows for them, they do something that isn't done in the U.S. or elsewhere, and that there is a procedure for people to get jobs here without sort of getting sort of...
skills.
Wow, okay. Yes, I mean, you could argue that. I was actually kind of trying to bring the mood a little bit up, Rachel. the fact... in the U.S., where there's tons and tons of undocumented illegal aliens sort of doing the same type of job, because there isn't really a recourse for hiring them into the system without being paid
Hong Kong, there's a setup to do this.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
But if you do something that is irregular in it, mechanisms to kind of make yourself right with the law are really limited.
Right.
And indeed, I mean, the other issue is that this class of people exists here in part because the relationship with the mainland can't be regularized. There's a huge population of labor just over there. But this would mean there's a reason that this is where this group of people came from before 1977.
Right. Nobody coming out from the mainland and sweeping nobody's floor. Not even legally, not from a preference point.
Not anymore. But that was how this was done until 1977.
Right.
And then geopolitical changes happen.
Yep. Which we aren't going into.
Right.
Because we need to get to the geeky stuff.
It's cooling. on this chapter. But I just wanted to give a special shout out to Regina Ip.
Who is who, Alice?
She is the Dolores Umbridge of Hong Kong politics.
Explique, s'il vous plaît.
She is the member of the Hong Kong political establishment who is there to make other people's evil look banal.
I like that.
And she's a kind
of... If she were a Game of Thrones character.
Oh, she thinks she's Varys, but she's actually... I don't know. You'd have to be kind of really oblivious as well as...
Evil. Like a bad Cersei mix.
So, Cersei is kind of way out of her league.
Okay. I got it. Okay, so...
But, yeah. Imagine, like, Marjorie Tyrell, but eviler?
Yeah. I'm working... And certainly much, much less hot.
Yeah. But...
A key
consideration.
No, I'm just...
But Regina has this week been talking about other people's sexual mores, which is as unappealing as it sounds.
Not that she's usually talking about her own, but...
but she, in addressing both several kind of recent scandals about mistreatment of domestic helpers and the Repulse Bay events...
Mm.
Posited that it wasn't the problem wasn't mistreatment of the domestic helpers. It was the domestic helpers were seducing expat men.
Yeah.
And she based this on what she described as things that had been confided in her when she was representing Discovery Bay. And
a noted flesh pot in Hong Kong.
Well, it's a noted pot of expats and their kind of wives in golf carts, and you know it's
not necessarily in that order.
But it's really it's very difficult to imagine even the most desperate Disco Bay tie tie confiding in Regina.
so I'm imagining that sort of like Peanuts sort of Lucy. Stand where sort of you know your counselor is real in,
and so the idea that this was you know I doubt the existence of even the anecdotal basis of this this critique, but it gives you some sense. And Regina is a kind of the other figure one might compare her to is the Duke of Edinburgh, who is capable of telling. You know, telling a joke or an anecdote that's you know offensive to two, three, four, five groups of sensitive people at once.
Right.
The Tina Fey version of Sarah Palin.
Yeah, there's a bit of that too, but it's a little less daffy.
Okay.
But you know, but I think actually Dolores Umbridge is pretty close because there's a kind of hard bureaucratic core there as well. So next time you're reading the South China Morning Post, picture all of these people together in a room.
Michelle Bachmann.
Better, but not religious.
Okay, fair enough.
That we know of.
Yes, but really racist.
So there, the Michelle Bachmann of Hong Kong, Regina Hip, and
I think that does have to be kind of taken into the atmosphere of this.
Yeah, because everyone thinks that these half million domestic helpers are here to find a man.
And I think that. That would come as a surprise to an awful lot of them.
Right. Moving, not swiftly, but onwards.
Surely
onwards. Let's move on to the global geekery stage. I think that through unanimous sort of pre-game decisions, we've decided that the Hugo Awards are where we're going. Is this, I mean, at the risk of this being sort of old news, I'm really, really fascinated, Rachel, in the way you sort of bricked it out for me before the mics went on. We have this venerable science fiction award that has kind of been the measure of what we read. Well, I mean, not everybody...
It's been a really useful list at various points.
And nobody has ever looked at the Hugo Award and said, whoa, that's probably a bad science fiction novel. Maybe something that you don't like. It's been something... Okay, it's not the Pulitzers, but it's a good measure of what science fiction...
is reading and excited about. What fandom is excited about.
And this year we have... a bit of a Gamergate-type controversy.
In fact, a very similar to Gamergate-type controversy. I think
and a very similar kind of facility that
indeed.
Has made it possible.
Right.
It is probably important to note because I did not really realize that the Yugos are something that your everyday
pronounce that
person
very French, by the way.
Can vote
the
for.
Yugos.
The Yugos is something that you and I, for only $40, can cast our ballot.
Really?
Yes. It's $40 to become a member of the governing body of the Yugos.
Mm.
You can also cast a ballot by going to one of three conventions, last year's, this year's, and next year's. And this is how you can nominate.
You can go to into the future?
You can go into the future, and you can nominate for works. There's a long list of things that they measure, including best podcast. So think about next year.
Hey, next year.
Best novel, and particularly for things like best podcast and best fanzine, the votes, the winning nominees are often determined by, say, a single vote or 42 votes or something like that. They're not overwhelming numbers, and even the best novel gets maybe a couple of thousand, maybe not even that many votes to be nominated.
So it's a highly swingable poll,
right?
Is what it turns
and so
out.
So what happened is a couple of years ago, a group calling itself the Sad Puppies decided that science fiction, the awards had been taken over by people who they call, what is it, social justice warriors or sad justice warriors, who only want to promote things that have lesbians and happy, touchy-feely-ness and stuff.
And not enough, I don't know, Robert Heinlein.
The quote essentially is that if you saw a lovely spaceship on a book cover, you could be pretty sure you're going to get a rousing space adventure. Nowadays, it's
that's
likely to be a story merely about racial prejudice and exploitation with interplanetary or interstellar trappings. And so these fellows, who may have had some good points and may have had some bad points, to be even-handed, put together a slate that they called the Sad Puppy Slate to nominate. But then another group of people who called themselves the Rabid Puppies, and who are, I think it is fair to say, rather more reprehensible. They referred to a rather famous and prominent black journalist as being barely civilized and probably not as Homo sapiens as other people might be, which is pretty much, I would say, beyond the pale.
Yep.
They put together a rabid puppy slate.
Stamp of approval.
Well, she's not Homo sapiens either, so I don't know if she's putting herself on that. And their slate, the rabid puppy slate, sort of went all the way and took most of the nominees. Not all of the
So
spots,
who was on this
spots.
Sort of the Nazi slate?
A guy named, mostly people I've never heard of.
A lot of people who were self-published, and a lot of people who were, the slates were very much made for nomination in some fashion. They would be, you know, they were sometimes not even,
right.
The books were not available, or.
So the people
Cliff Notes, what is a slate?
It's a selected group of works that you nominate as a block. So instead of saying, here are some suggested works, and you look at them and say, I read that, and I loved it, and I read that, and I loved it, and I'm going to vote for those, you say, I'm going to vote for this entire block just as it was written out for me. It's the equivalent of going into a voting booth and punching the party ticket as opposed to voting for individuals,
uh-huh.
I would say.
Well, and one of the other aspects of the whole kind of, you know, the sad puppies, rabid puppies, etc., is that this idea that, you know, you could pay $40 and do this, in the past, mostly the only people who cared to do that were people who read a lot of science fiction books. And what had, you know, when this kind of went around very kind of gamergatily, as a, you know, as a propaganda,
well adverbed,
you know, as a kind of a sense of online grievance, lots of people who didn't really read this stuff, whatever they
just
thought it should
on.
Be like, started to vote.
And
so
just so they just so sorry to interject here, but did they just plunk down their $40, like, I'm incensed and I've got $40 worth of spare change?
That is certainly one interpretation of what has happened. Trying to be as broad-minded as possible. So the
list came out.
Mm-hmm. People who claimed that they had not been contacted by the Sad Puppies or the Rabid Puppies to ask if they wanted to be on this slate. Two of the best novel candidates have withdrawn their name. One of the best novel and one of the best novel stories withdrawn their names from consideration. So they've said, I am going to drop out rather than win this award because of the stuff that's associated with it.
Right.
George R. R. Martin, who I think we can say, no matter what your feelings about how long it's taking him to write his book.
He's a very prominent fantasy writer.
Is potentially...
You reckon?
The prominent fantasy writer has come out to call this a travesty, essentially, and has been attacked by the rabid puppies for not understanding. And so now there are questions about whether there's an ability to vote on the Hugo's Noah Award. Whether every you vote Noah Award for everybody.
Right.
I think we should have a nominating committee who should, select two candidates. And then, everyone can have a vote on the
topic. I see what you did there. Threaded it back into Hong Kong politics. Yeah, we could have totally Hong Kong politics.
Could.
It's like, you can vote for who we say you can vote for. So, bottom line this.
Bottom line. So I think if you care about the idea that science fiction has an award that has managed to become very prestigious, but is really from the fans, which makes
right.
it pretty cool. This is something you should be concerned about or potentially interested in, and think about spending $40 to vote for yourself. Three of the best novel candidates are not rabid puppies. One of them is Ancillary Justice by Anne Leckie, which is fabulous. One of them is Catherine Addison's Goblin Emperor, which is also very good.
Yeah, I've heard good things about that.
And The Three-Body Problem, which we have talked about a couple of times.
I think I've heard good things about this from you.
I think that was
the first 15 pages were awesome.
I've gotten all the way to halfway, 47% through this book. And so, potentially worth voting for the... It would probably be kind of funny if after all the rabid puppies... Ancillary Justice, which is very much a book about gender and its concerns and colonialism and its concerns, while being a rousing space opera...
Right.
The award. So,
right.
spend $40, vote for Ancillary Justice. That's my bottom line. And then we'll fix
Excellent.
The nomination
right.
process down the road. Not that the other books were great.
Right.
But I love that one the most of those three.
But self-published sort of libertarian Nazi trolls in Norway don't vote for them much.
No.
Vote for them a little less. But moderately. And fairly. If you love their work.
Right.
I don't want to meet you,
I don't really want to get gamer-gated, we're going to...
Right on.
Yeah, indeed.
Now, other topics on the global geekery front.
Daredevil, which I think I'm the only one who liked.
No. I know you think that I hate everything.
Yes.
I am the Mikey.
You are, you are the sad puppy.
I am the sad puppy of the podcast.
But you are not the racist rabbit puppy, so we're happy about that.
Both anyway. Those things are true, Rachel. I'm not all the way through. I'm 9 episodes in.
God, do you guys consume culture at all?
What? You watch it all the way through?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean... 9 episodes. I'm almost there, man.
I think you 2 hours a night.
I'm a new teacher. They're trying to add somebody else earlier,
yeah.
And they're like,
"No." I mean, I'm there.
All right,
I mean,
fair enough.
I mean, I'm not even sort of little bit of sort of inside baseball for all you dystopian present viewers at home. We've got a mutual friend who gauges the quality of media on the speed with which he watches
<That's>
it.
<true. laughs>
And so most things, if it's really good, he'll watch it at only 2x speed. And
don't do that.
Right. No. What I'm saying is, if we take that as the measure,
it's true.
I would watch it at 0.75 times. Wasn't a huge Daredevil fan growing up, but I was a reasonable Daredevil fan, both kind of pre-Frank Miller's incarnation and then into it. I mean, I'm slightly older than both you ladies, and I remember Daredevil as kind of a wisecracky, blind Spider-Man, and then he kind of got dark and Catholic.
Then he became a self-pitying... blind Punisher for a while.
That's like I said, dark and Catholic. Then, and I've still got that first issue where Elektra appears somewhere. I think it's in my sister's basement. And it's probably one of the one comic I have that's actually probably worth something. Mm. But this, as most folks in internet land know, this kind of picks up on the Frank Miller trope. I mean, as toxic as Frank Miller has become, he has influenced so many in modern interpretations of the superhero. He is the archetype for Batman on screen. He is now the archetype for
Superman, which is much more bizarre.
Yeah.
No, I remain very unhappy about that.
That movie was just awful. But that's
that movie has become a kind of, you know, like, is there an Ayn Rand book on the shelf? Did they think the Superman was okay? Well, then you just that's a deal breaker. There.
I'm building low cost housing the way I want. Go away. Just what? In the Arctic.
Well, in Marin County. But I'm divided about the Frank Miller-ness of this
incarnation of Daredevil.
I think there's a moment, kind of somewhere in the first episode, where you're like, "Oh my God, they're not going to embarrass themselves," and that's a moment of great elation, given
right.
what happened last time with Daredevil.
I've never seen that movie.
Don't
ever.
It's really terrible. The guy
that runs this site is actually a bit of a original movie apologist. Not that he...
Couldn't have been worse than Superman, and I sat through that.
Ideologically, it was not worse. In terms of kind of production script as a movie.
It was worse.
It gave a fine fight to the bottom, but, you know, the people who put that together were not fascists. So it's a, you know...
That was better.
Okay.
But...
and now we know what we need to
start. Scoring great ideological points.
But the sense that this, you know, but it still makes me... That still haunts me as a presence behind when will they get to Elektra. So far, I think, actually, the thing about the new series that I am most impressed by is that they are actually managing to have some women characters who are characters.
Yeah,
it has the Bechdel test in at least a couple of episodes.
But that's remarkable given, you know, how this was not a strength of the Daredevil comic, and the Daredevil comic had strengths, but it isn't kind of where you would where you would expect this to be coming necessarily.
So there's one episode, and I don't know how far you guys are.
Three episodes.
Don't worry, I'm pretty spoiler-proof, so don't worry.
Without getting... There is one episode about the repercussions of keeping a secret identity. And that I thought was very honest and very well done about the sense of betrayal that a character would find out that someone that they love and trust and thought that they could rely on was doing something else entirely.
You're being very gentle about it. Do I need to, like, create some sort of sound effect for spoiler alert?
I meant
for the listening public.
I
don't think she spoiled anything here.
I'm just saying where you're going.
So, and then once the secret is out and the repercussions have set in, the next episode, they're still... reverberating or repercussing or whatever. They're percussing along. It's not suddenly like, oh, I found out about your secret. Now, I happen to very much enjoy The Flash a lot. I really enjoy it because it's fun and it's light, but a couple of people have recently been let in on the secret of who, and this is also true in The Arrow as it happens recently, about like,
oh, it's gotten
hilarious. You're the superhero, and everybody's like, all right, cool. And they have maybe 30 seconds of being like, no one have told me, or how come I didn't realize that when you put the mask on, you were totally a different person? How could I not have figured that out? But having said that, particularly in Arrow, which is a little egregious, in The Flash, he has like a full face thing. But anyway,
and in Daredevil, he's blind.
They move on very, very rapidly.
Who's that other blind guy I know?
He could see through that mask, couldn't he?
They sort of move on, and that has a lack of integrity that is okay in a show that I'm watching on the WB and that I enjoy very much, but. There was something about that that gave it a gravity. Now, there are several things that I don't like about it. It is really grim. They do, I think, spend a lot of time endangering children and women in a way that I think is a little bit of an easy...
Let her go.
They kidnap a small child at the end of episode one, right?
Yeah,
and he's sort of in peril, and like they're sort of implying. So there is something I think shorthand about that that I think sometimes is a little too shorthanded. Or
fair enough.
That I get a little frustrated with.
You don't watch much Sons of Anarchy, do you?
I would not. No.
That's all about the
that would not be
the,
something
the
I
dependent
would, I would
endangerment.
Probably enjoy.
That should just be called Dependent Endangerment of Anarchy.
But this particular show, I thought, got better as it went along. So there is that. Mm-hmm. It does not get less grim, but it manages to say, if you get punched in the face and kicked a lot, there's a fight scene in episode two where it is clear that our hero is hurting.
Oh,
and
yeah.
That counts for, so they are able to kind of keep their feet. That's my defense of the show.
No. Absolutely. The fact that Daredevil is, you know, perhaps it took a little bit longer. I haven't sort of seen it through the end, but I hear through the interwebs that he does actually kind of get around to his costume. And
I'm hoping that maybe his kind of fighting develops a little, so maybe it isn't all about taking punishment.
Yeah, I mean, but there again,
really,
you know, sort of.
Is he ever going to
see that you're just like, holy shit, how are you still alive?
At the same time, however, that in and of itself, I mean, kind of draws you in a way that other superhero tropes don't. I mean, yeah, he gets up, yeah, he has superpowers, but he's bleeding and beggared, and yes, he's using things that, the thing I like about it the most is the way that anything that looks like a billy club, but isn't a billy club, gets used like a billy club. So, I mean, again, I don't know how far into the comics you are, but like,
the
billy club, but the thing is, like, you know, the Batarang, not that, that was Batman's real thing, but like, for every super...
It's really his trademark.
It
his
is,
trademark
it is.
Weapon, and I assume that at a certain point, you know, these things will kind of, you know, the various trademarks, given that, you know, he's in his Daredevil costume and the promo stuff for the
right.
for the show, I assume that, you know, these things will kind of come together.
Right.
And as in a number of the kind of new launches of superhero things, they're kind of, you know, trying to naturalize this stuff.
Yeah. And did a great job in the naturalization of Foggy. I mean, again, a very comic booky thing. You know, there are very few Marvel comics where, I mean, there's lots of comics where there's a normal foil and whatnot, but there are very few where that foil is an adult and doesn't have to skin up in tights and fight alongside. Daredevil is one of the few major comic book characters where his foil is just a schlubby bro who hangs out with him, and Falky isn't really even schlubby or a bro. He's, you know, he's obviously
a good dude. I do like the fact that they're actually kind of, you know, they're doing some law, which is actually a big problem with Arrow, where Lauren, in addition to her other problems, is the worst Laurel.
Yes.
Is the worst lawyer in the world.
And one of the not great actresses.
Oh, no, that's, well, leave that on its own.
Not to be critical.
But her, you know, she only knows how to blackmail people, which, as far as I know, is not actually a legal skill.
I think it would depend on who you asked about
they're
lawyers.
Exactly.
It does make me very
zero lawyers here
Jessica
tonight.
Jones. Because it's just sort of taking a step back about Netflix in general. Bloodlines, I don't know if anyone saw it, with the Kyle Chandler.
Nope.
Quite good. Unbreakable Kimmy Schmidt.
Yeah.
A lot of fun.
Super fun.
I thought this was good. Was it the best thing I've ever seen? No. Was it worth lying
was
on
it
my
the best super okay, I've never seen Arrow or The Flash.
Me?
I have not. I live vicariously through both of you on both those things.
So,
I must say, I am very particular and picky about my superhero consumption on digital devices.
If I had to pick one of them that I wanted more of, I think I would pick Peggy Carter, which surprises me a little bit coming out of my mouth, but where that character would go and what season two would look like is much more interesting to me. Even though I've watched all of The Arrow and will continue to watch all of The Arrow and all of The Flash and will continue to watch all of The Flash, I even turned around on Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. But of all of those...
Wait a minute, turned around which way? Like pro
from
or con?
Being like, I'm so bored by this show.
It did a total Joss Whedon.
Right, which doesn't always make things better.
Well, in this case, it really did. I mean, okay. but it was that Joss Whedon where it started out really dull,
and then
it became really good.
But I think some of that is the lead actress, and some of it is that it is a lead actress and not a leading man, and there was a lot less getting punched in the face in that. It was much more like, it combined the elements of The Flash that I love, which is that it's fun, and you don't always feel like you're going to watch it and be like, bang, the world is ending, this is so fucking awful and dreadful and depressing. And but still had some gravity.
Explicit language.
As opposed to...
Well, I just, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about the Flash slash the Arrow, and they have different tones, and they kind of work. But I like their B-moviness.
I like it, too.
And it's not, you know, the Daredevil...
men are easy on the eyes, particularly Mr. Amell on Arrow.
Well, come on, man. I mean, Daredevil's getting all kinds of shirtless for Rosario Dawson all the time.
The thing is that Daredevil has to kind of succeed as a more quality vehicle than either of those two.
True.
Because why?
Because it's production values and the kind of acting. Just going the Frank Miller way means that you have to not bust up laughing about it all the time.
Right.
You have to kind of take it seriously. It has to have a certain gravitas.
I think it may
succeed in that, but I just want to kind of big up for a moment the idea of doing it well, which is tricky.
It is. And when you get right down to it, there's some like real law going on, but it's not freaking LA law.
No. But just the fact that I like the fact that he's kind of supposed to be semi-competent in his day job.
I do have a day job, and I occasionally show up.
But part of the reason that Frank Miller, the Frank Miller tropes, have come into film and now these kind of cable productions so consistently is because part of it is saying to you, this is serious. It may come from a comic book, but it's serious, and I deal with serious things, and they're manly, eternal guilt things, and they're, and it's really Catholic.
And if I could get David Mamet to write the script, I would.
That too is a kind of shorthand for a set of cultural values, some of which these productions, sometimes they man up and do it, but it's always manning up and doing it.
Yeah.
What if people know about Jessica Jones, which is supposed to drop at the end of this year? I do not know anything about either the comic book character that it is based on, or very much else, but it's in the Marvel Universe, and her name is Jessica Jones.
A blank slate.
Played by Kristen Ritter, who I do not really get as the choice for anything, but that's
the thing. Well, there you are. I haven't been following that one.
Okay, cool.
But
I'm excited to see it.
Alright.
I understand where you're going with Peggy Carter, but I did think... I don't think it was quite right.
I don't think it was quite right either, but I'd be most interested in seeing more of it. Maybe because it wasn't quite right.
Maybe.
All right, final thoughts on Daredevil until we move to the last segment.
Watch it. But not with your children. No. It's not that kind of show.
Oh, God, no.
Don't even.
Just in case. Nothing on Netflix that we've mentioned is that kind of show. Is it happening?
I'm sorry, I knew
another thing not to watch with your children, ever. Penny Dreadful is coming back.
Right.
Yay!
You guys have been fully outed on this podcast as full-fledged Penny Dreadfulites. So
it's fine. And a different genre.
Got it. I'm moving into this group.
Peaky Blinders, which I finally saw the end of the second season.
I should watch that.
You really, really should. And that was also
funny, or is it?
It has moments of humor, but it's also, it's kind of ingeniously plotted.
Got it.
It's in a kind of, bizarre fantasy Birmingham.
It's actual Birmingham, is that it?
And it's very art directed. And it's just, it's full of kind of satisfying character symmetries and things. It really, one of those things where you expect things to kind of dip in the middle of the season or something, and it just kind of builds and builds and builds. And it'll have a third season. It's been commissioned for a third.
Next time we should talk about that in Orphan Black, which is awesome.
We're always thinking about watching that.
We're not talking about the tonight.
Okay, carrying on.
Carrying on, because we are now talking, quickly moving through the local scene. Alice and I went to resolve our shoegazy differences. Femano.
On a basketball court.
We went to see UK's finest, sort of glossiest, youngest shoegazy act.
I bet they're not the youngest anymore. They got two albums out.
I know, yeah, exactly. Yuck. We went to go see the Yuck Show a couple weeks back.
It's a review.
And, I probably should listen to a little bit more of them before I coaxed you into the show. But we had some decent tempora ahead of time.
And they were okay.
Yeah.
Had some
moments. Weren't as loud. I really wanted them louder. I wanted them buckler louder.
I don't think they actually got louder.
No, yeah, exactly.
I think you had improved them in your own.
Yeah, I did. In my mind, they were super loud.
But the pleasant surprise,
yes,
which was not that frequent, was their opening band.
Yes,
who were
Thud.
The onomatopoetically named Thud.
A Hong Kong band. Okay, pick three other bands, triangulate them for me. Go.
Little bit of, oh, sorry, you should have asked me that earlier.
And yet I didn't.
Yes, no. there was a, them with a French keyboard player. Sorry, I'm just losing
it. No.
French disco is one of their biggest hits.
Yes, okay, yeah. So there was what's that, Tahiti 88 or whatever those guys are, those French keyboard.
You're going to have to cut this as I remember the name of the band.
Please hold.
Can't help you with that one. Sorry.
Oh, no, it's really... Stereolab!
Yes, they were very Stereolab-y. They were super Stereolab-y.
They were Stereolab-y with a hint of... There was a general kind of hint of chanson.
Okay.
Going, and they, it was very dreamy. I would say it was actually not...
Dreamy, but they got loud.
Yeah, but I would actually say they were a ways from shoegaze, and it was more kind of... more atmospheric washes.
Right at us,
and cool.
They did not look at their shoes at all.
No, and they put on a bit of a show. The stage banter was,
hey,
random and hilarious. and
they were fronted, and this is your whole shoegaze theory in general. They were fronted by a manic pixie dream girl.
Is that this is a genre insofar as it can be constituted as a genre, which has a density of Asian female players and front people not seen elsewhere, and people are both this is a way to connect with the audience here, and also people are sometimes just visiting their parents.
Right.
And this is this
maybe, Hong Kong maybe, and answers, rock out.
Maybe answers the question about why these bands tour here so disproportionately often.
Right. Okay. So you cracked the code.
Go and see Thud if they're coming anywhere near you.
Exactly. And the next time they appear, I will definitely be like that hipster we encountered on the way in.
We saw them when they were an opening act.
Yeah, exactly. I've nice. Just come for the opening act.
Yeah, and also, and actually, the venue was pleasingly organic for Hong Kong, which is,
it was a basketball court.
It was a basketball court in the youth club, and this actually was kind of offered more romance than I would say most other places I have seen bands play here.
Yep.
I'm going to see Katy Perry at the Venetian in 2 weeks.
Right. There'll be no basketball.
Not any organic qualities whatsoever.
And we will question you off mic about why it is that that, that sentence was uttered. Final act tonight, Canto Cine Corner.
Yay!
I'm going to get some theme music ramped up for Canto Cine Corner. But we will, on every episode of Dystopian Present, be reviewing something out of Hong Kong's cinematic... You can't say ouvoir for a country, can you?
I don't say you can... Ouvoir would mean a worker.
Okay.
I think you mean...
Alice with the big French brains. Yeah, all right. So well, how would... Okay. Give me a pretentious phrase to describe what I'm trying to say.
I think I would just go with Hong Kong cinema.
Right. Hong Kong cinema. All right. Yay!
film.
Right. So for whatever we will try to get this out to the viewing public earlier, but this time we've decided to go
space
with...
Space off for a better tomorrow.
Well, ironically, our pick this week had none of those qualities, but it was a bit of a Hong Kong genre mashup. We reviewed Gangster Payday, or as it is actually known in Chinese, Big Tea House, which once again sort of reinforces...
I came third at the Civil Service exam.
reinforces the notion that there's no inner logic between what a film is called in English and what it is called in Cantonese. So Big Tea House / Gangster Payday. Stars Anthony Wong, who is probably, he is a stalwart of the Canto film scene, probably best known as the curmudgeonly detective in the Infernal Affairs series. He was the Martin Sheen guy. I mean, I know it kind of feels sacrilegious to sort of refer to him that way, but Martin Sheen's role in The Departed was Anthony Wong's scene in Infernal Affairs.
I should confess that potentially, like some of our listeners, this is the first Hong Kong cinema film I think I have ever seen. It is also the first Hong Kong cinema film adaptation I believe I have ever seen, because The Departed is not a movie that I would want to watch, as a side note. So this was probably not the movie to introduce me to Hong Kong cinema, as a side note. But that's
was anything on fire?
No.
Okay, so Anthony Wong, who is one of the mainstays of Cantonese cinema. Charlene Choi, I think it is. I'm trying to go to my notes here, and it's failing
me. I need to give you
me.
A little bit.
Charlene Choi.
It's hard for me to stream them on the bus on my way to and from work when I don't feel like reading a book, which is a very peculiar set of circumstances.
Right.
And
okay, so we
will... It's a brave new world.
Bottom line.
Yes.
A triad film, but not like your sort of gritty sort of triad.
It was a weird film.
Yeah. Okay. Many...
But was it?
But, yeah. It was. Plot summary. An aging triad, Don, who is kind of heading into his gentle years. He's sort of... He's like the kinder, gentler face of
he's
the tribe.
He's looking to go more legit.
Yeah.
He's out of the violence.
Yeah, he's running a karaoke joint, and every now and again he's got to break a beer bottle over somebody's head.
Or eight.
But, you know, on the grand scheme of things, that's not so bad. And he
nice to his ex-wife.
He's nice to his ex-wife, and he's become infatuated with this younger... tea lady. I said she runs a tea shop across the way.
She is really entitled and annoying.
Yes. Well, that's Charlene Choi's milieu.
Is it? I was like watching her, and I was like, I want to get you so badly, which I do not think.
Yeah.
How I am supposed to feel.
So she is the traditional foil in a lot of Hong Kong films, which is...
Is she always that obnoxious?
Yeah, mm-hmm. I think so.
Yeah.
You
so
had a lot of consistent character cast.
Yeah, so there's unfortunately, again, back to the whole discussion earlier about gender roles in Hong Kong films, there's usually the plucky but innocent but annoying sort of Madonna character, and then there's everybody else in the massage
this
parlor.
Was the problem, like, she didn't seem to me there. She seemed neither plucky nor intrepid.
She was a little plucky,
or enterprising, or anything.
She ran a shop, a tea shop that was under.
But in a way, that's like she seemed to be deeply incompetent at everything she tried to
do.
Yeah,
she wasn't good at it. But
but not good at it in a way that was intelligent. Good in a way that I'm too busy sucking a lollipop to deliver the food, which is my job, on time. And I was like, I have limited sympathy for this.
So the main thing that I got out of this film was there was sort of this super, super... I mean, this many Hong Kong films these days are just basically throwing in the frickin' kitchen sink. They are both a triad drama and a romantic comedy and
a... He dresses a man and some ducks.
That were no, well, were there any trannies in this? No. But it was also like super slice of life. So there's three or four vectors of Hong Kong cinema. There's the triad thing, and with lots of gushing blood. There's the meet cute rom com. There's the, isn't Hong Kong so hectic and wacky street-side slice-of-life drama thing. And then there's...
Forbidden Love?
Yeah, there's, yeah, a whole lot of Forbidden Love. Wow! A whole lot of Forbidden Love. Wow!
Oh,
so, yeah, so... It had packed all those in, and yes, I can understand, if this was your first foray, I can understand why you wouldn't appreciate it, because you wouldn't have had any reference points to all the other, you couldn't have, like, dissected it for all its parts.
That is true.
I liked it because it was filmed...
It was like watching four movies at once.
It was like watching a movie that was filmed a block from the dystopian present studios here.
I did enjoy the slice of life aspect of it. And I did amuse my local colleagues by asking them various very stupid questions, which we had lots of fun with. And they bought me a pineapple bun.
Right.
I still don't know what's in them.
No pineapple.
That's what I took away.
That's the great irony.
It's called a pineapple bun because the texture on top
looks like a pineapple.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's what I thought they were trying to tell me, but I was like, it doesn't, though. And they were like, it does. I'm like, it doesn't. Anyway.
It looks more like a pineapple than...
Than an apple or an orange.
Yes.
That's what that texture as a topping is always referred to. If you want a real treat, go to Tim Ho Wan and get the pineapple bun-topped pork bun.
Okay.
Pro tip.
Jim Hogan is delicious, but I've not had that much.
This was their invention, and it is now
worth
available in many venues in Hong Kong, but they are the originators.
So, all in all, because it was such a mashup, it probably didn't deliver.
Right over my head.
Right. But I think, like, if you are a super, super Kento film hardcore fan...
Are you listening to this podcast?
I hope that you are, because you should be, because this probably hits a number of your things.
Ghost was the older, it was played by the older gentleman, Anthony Wong.
Yeah.
Anthony Wong. I thought that character was interesting.
Now,
and the brother 1 and 2, or uncle 1 and 2.
Yeah.
It was just the girl who I was like, I find you utterly irritating, and that is a problem in your accent.
This is not a fun fact, this is more of a fun speculation. He was called Aguai, or Ghost, and for those of us all in the known, a Guailo is a foreigner, or an Guai means ghost.
Oh.
And Anthony Wong is half English.
Oh.
So I'm wondering if his nickname was generated by his half-casteness.
Huh.
And I'll leave it there.
Cool.
And I think we should leave this podcast here.
Okay.
So, last words, last thoughts, last regrets?
Are we endorsing or are we doing that at my...
You're endorsing. Go on. Let's do a quick round of endorsing.
So I have been reading Joe Walton. I don't know if anyone has read Among Others, which was her Hugo-winning book.
Right.
Even though
before
she was a woman.
Before those Nazis took it over.
And not an American. Which, I have to say, the biggest predictor of whether or not you'll win is being from the good old US of A. She's Canadian. That definitely doesn't count. But I read her book about Plato's Republic, which I have not read, and which kind of made me want to read it, but not badly enough to actually do it. The Just City, and I recommend it. And I'm currently reading her book Farthing, which is about what would happen if the British had made accommodation to Hitler in around 1942, and it is depressing and scary, and I'm reading it slowly because it makes me very sad. And I recommend both of them, along with Among Others, if you have not read it. It is
despite the sadness that ensues.
I haven't finished writing yet, so I don't know that I can completely recommend it, but it is alternate history, and it is well done, says the person who has studied World War II somewhat exhaustively.
So got it.
How's that going for it?
I've been reading the... I've been reading a series of books by Benedict Jacka, which are in the urban fantasy genre, and which is kind of bottom feeding at this point in terms of fantasy genres. They all have titles like Fated, Cursed, Taken. And
one was enough.
And there's an endless series of them. Which is handy if you're trying not to make decisions. It's set in London, which is its sort of biggest weakness, because in that way it's weighing into not only a city that has been crisscrossed by urban fantasy, but also... So his place setting is great, but in pleasant contrast to Ben Aronovich's Rivers of London, which is otherwise utterly superior to this, he can write action.
Okay.
So this is the strength of the books rather than the kind of fertility of his magical imagination.
Right.
So particularly if you're waiting and waiting and waiting for another Rivers of London book, read these. There's like 17 of them.
Got it.
And they go like that.
Excellent.
Cool.
No, I have not read anything since The Buried Giant. I've been trying and failing to complete the Daredevil ouvre, so I've got nothing for you this time, so I'm going to leave you, and with that, and with my greatest thanks to my co-hosts Allison and Rachel, I'm going to say goodnight from Hong Kong.
Good night.
Good night. Thanks for all the fish.